You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Brian Callen, my colleague, Hunter Motz, and I sound so formal. our guest, the esteemed professor, doctor, All-American springboard diver, young man, youngest tenured professor in Wharton's history. If you know anything about Wharton, it's basically the best business school in, well, the world, or at least up there. Adam Grant is on the phone. He's written, this is kind of ridiculous. You're the single highest rated teacher. You've been recognized as one of Business Week's favorite professors, one of the world's 40 best business professors under 40, and one of Malcolm Gladwell's favorite social science writers. And previously a record-setting advertising director at Let's Go Publication, an All-American springboard diver, and hold, a professional magician. Get the fuck out of here. I mean, it just keeps going. Adam is the author of Give and Take, and that's what we're here to talk about. And let me just, very quickly, New York Times and Wall Street Journal, bestseller, and it's being translated into 24 languages, named one of the best books of 2013 by Amazon, Apple, the Financial Times, and the Wall Street Journal as one of Oprah's riveting reads. Come on, dude. It's ridiculous. Fortune's most read business book, Harvard Business Review's Ideas That Shaped Management, and the Washington Post book every reader should read. I mean, get out of here. You know what? This is the end. I'm done. I just wanted you to come on so you can hear that, and the podcast is over. Thank you so much for joining us. Dude, and by the way, he did it all by just being a good guy and giving to other people. And that would be the theme of your book, that you get ahead, not by reading and following Robert Greene's 48 Laws of Power or reading Machiavelli, but in fact, by nurturing your generous spirit. You give countless examples, Portland Trailblazers, this optimal 2 hours a week kind of giving and all these things.
George Meyer, who was really one of the big creative geniuses behind The Simpsons, like loads and loads of people.
Yeah. So, Adam, I've talked enough. I've given you. We should have had trumpets in the background. I don't know. Teach us, sir. Teach us.
Thanks for that, Brian. I clearly have no life, and you are too easily impressed.
Well, listen, man, you're an impressive guy, and the book it seems is rather revolutionary. At least it's making waves that way. You know,
especially in the business world, right? Because I mean, the conception of how you get ahead in business is by like being ruthless and really looking out for number one.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who think that, right? The idea is, like, I have to be a really selfish taker in order to succeed and always be all about me. And I think the world has changed, and it's increasingly difficult to do that, although there are still some people who get away with it. But the good news is there are lots of people out there trying to punish takers and make sure that they fail. So
really?
It makes it pretty hard to sustain your success.
Explain to me how they're doing that.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about takers versus givers and matchers. So the takers are the people who are trying to get as much as possible from others, don't want to give anything back unless they have to. They're the free riders and social loafers among us. Mm-hmm. Givers are the people who just enjoy helping others and often do it with no strings attached. And then most of us fall in the middle of that spectrum as matchers. We believe in an eye for an eye, a just world, kind of you do something for me, I'll do something for you. Mm-hmm. So Brian, if you're a matcher, there's nothing you hate more than seeing a taker act selfishly and get away with it, because that's a violation of justice.
Yes.
And so when you meet a taker, you feel like you've just got to become the karma police. It's sort of your mission in life to just punish the hell out of that person.
Right.
So, you know, in some cases, as a matcher, you might go out of your way to directly sabotage a taker. You might feed them false information, try to undermine their success. But most matchers will choose an ancient, more subtle but equally deadly weapon, which is called gossip.
Oh, well, you know, I the book resonates with me, and the philosophy resonates with me. This is not about me talking about how generous I am, because I could be way more generous. But I will say that I took a little inventory of my life, and I was always criticized by my mom and when I was in relationships for spending a little too much time worrying about other people, my friends. I have a list of people I give money to secretly, like ex women who a woman who used to clean my house who then went blind from diabetes, etc., etc. I keep some of these things hidden from my wife, who gets, you know, she's understandably like, we have two kids and you just can't do this. Blah, blah, blah. I do it out of a sense, I think, of guilt and, yes, compassion. I think I grew up all over the world and saw a lot of poverty, and I've always felt lucky for no reason. And so, you know.
And you also feel guilty about having money that you didn't earn.
That's right. Money that I didn't earn. Just I was born on third base.
Right.
White guy, 2014. It's a lot of what my stand-up, my next hour special is about. And so, you know, but I did a little research, and I did a little sort of like an inventory. And yes, I've given a lot of money, and I've only been paid back once. But but it's all somehow I'm still in the black. It's actually a profitable enterprise, because I've gotten it. Somehow people do you favors, or somehow maybe it's you put yourself in that kind of a position, and it just makes your life better in many ways. I don't know how to really quantify it, but I am a fan of not that this. Some people have famine thinking, and anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that your philosophy very much resonates with me.
Well, I find that completely shocking, but I'm delighted to hear it.
why do you find that shocking?
Well, I think that one of the things that many givers struggle with is making fun of other people. Right, so like stereotypically, it's not necessarily obvious that you would find a comedian who actually cares about others.
This is very.
I feel like you have something to say about that.
Well, I think you're right. I think that a lot, you know, there's a lot of these theories about comedy comes from pain, and comics are degenerates, or comics are solitary people. But I don't think so. I figured out a long time ago that my gift, what I was able to do to make the world a better place, wasn't wield a sword and kill bad guys, although I'd love that. It was more, I'm just a complete jackass, and I'm good at making people laugh. And so once I embraced the idea that that's my mission, to be essentially recess and get up and I got genes or whatever it is that makes me want to entertain people, that's my job. So then sometimes when you're done with a show, people say, you know, this, my husband died 2 years ago. It's the first time I've laughed in 2 years. And I'm like, really? Well, you got a nice body. You want to come? No, I don't do that. Adam, I don't do that. I'm just saying.
Anymore.
Not anymore. The point is, I don't take advantage of bereaved widows anymore. I'm married. Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's just, I really think, Adam, it's a question of perspective.
But it's also, I mean, you know, part of what you really deal with in the book, Adam, is the fact that, you know, it's not as simple as that givers always do better and takers always do worse, right? There are subtleties within that, right? Like some givers do really well, they do well over the long term, but it's also about having boundaries on your giving, right?
Absolutely. So the data show over and over again that whether you look at engineers, salespeople, medical students, the givers are overrepresented both among the worst performers and the best performers. So good guys and gals are more likely to finish last, but they're also more likely to finish first. And you do find sort of these two groups of givers. There's one group that burns out and gets exploited by takers, and then there's another that turns out to be just amazingly productive and generous at the same time. And when you look at that latter group, they do set a lot of boundaries, right? They're thoughtful about who they help. They're not as generous with takers as they are with everybody else. They're careful to give in ways that they actually enjoy and excel at, so that they're not constantly getting distracted or exhausted or even just failing to help. And then they make sure to block time to get their own work done. And when they do that, it turns out to work pretty well.
Don't you find that there are some people that play the martyr and it's an excuse not to get what they should get done? Aren't there people out there, and I know several, who take the world on their shoulders and it's an excuse not to really do the work they're supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I think there are certainly people who operate that way, right? They know that they're not going to be productive, or they're procrastinating, and so it's like, well, I'm really helping somebody else, and that's why I didn't get my stuff done. And I think that obviously is a sort of lame excuse, and I would love to see more people say, look, I'm going to help, but I'm also going to make progress toward my own goals.
Yeah. And ultimately, by doing that, you can be much more helpful than by being the suffering martyr.
I think that is almost undoubtedly true.
Spoken like a true professor. Yeah,
there's a book called The Science of Getting Rich, which was sort of a self-help book, you know, written in 1900. It's a really interesting book. And one of the things that he says is, I don't believe in charity. A loaf of bread just keeps a man in his misery a little longer. I believe in inspiration. What do you think of that statement? And when you talk about giving, can you quantify that?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, you know, it's like it's always better to sort of teach someone to fish than to give them a fish, right?
Yeah.
We've all been exposed to cliches that sort of deliver that message. But when I think about giving, I think it's actually not about being a philanthropist or a volunteer the way most people think about it. I think it just means enjoying helping others and being willing to do it without some kind of quid pro quo expectation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you think about giving, to me, it means sharing your knowledge, mentoring other people, making introductions, or just, you know, in some cases, showing up early or staying late to support the people around you. And, you know, you could think about that as a form of charity. But I would say it's in many cases more important to inspire people to engage in those behaviors than it is to get them to donate a little bit of money.
And also, that's the thing. It actually requires a lot more of us to do those things. Like, giving money is fairly thoughtless. Like, it doesn't require any empathy. It doesn't require any understanding. It doesn't really require much of you to give much of yourself emotionally.
Yeah, you don't even have to write a check now, right? You can click a button.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Whereas maybe taking somebody who's younger and gently or in your own way kind of say, I always say to people, listen, here's why you should listen to me. I'm just older and I've made a lot more mistakes. So I am better at pattern recognition. I can see you driving toward this wall. I've driven into that frickin' wall 15 times. Just turn the wheel a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why you should listen to me. And I find when you frame things like that, you really, it's way more effective. But let me ask you this. Are you saying then that, you know, as a professor of business, you know, when somebody comes up with an idea, they just had the guy who created GoPro and he's worth $10 billion or something. But when you create an idea and you create a company around that idea, are you saying then that not only should a great deal of your business culture be about giving just for the sake of giving, but that also in many ways will push your company, you're more likely to have a profitable enterprise. I mean, in other words, does the data support that really?
Yeah, it does. Although if you do it to succeed, it tends not to work. And I think that's the paradox, right? You, the moment you say, well, I'm going to strategically help others in order to get ahead, it starts to become either transactional or transparent.
I was going to say it's transparent. We can smell that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there is a ton of evidence gathered over the last 35 years that the more frequently people are helping each other inside organizations, the better those organizations do on every metric you can measure, whether you're interested in profits or customer satisfaction, employee retention, operating costs. I think that's not surprising, actually, when you think about it, because when people are giving, they're constantly connecting different people and different ideas. That's good for innovation. And givers are also just willing to do stuff that's not in their job description but critical to organizational effectiveness. So, yeah, I do spend a lot of time working with organizations on building a culture of productive giving. And I think for me, a lot of that is about saying, look, it's not just being like a responsible corporation or trying to be a good corporate citizen, but it's actually about the everyday behaviors that your employees engage in.
Well, and one of the things that I love so much about the book is you do a really good job of picking really good stories that illustrates these points, right? The optician, you know, George Meyer. I mean, would you mind talking us through some of those stories? Because I think that gives the listeners a real sense of what the book is and how we can see that in action.
I can't say no to that, can I?
I know you probably had to do this 1,000 times.
Yeah.
No, I'm perfectly happy to do it. Which stories are most interesting to you guys?
I mean, the optician one I thought was great,
just
in terms of those attitudes.
Yeah.
So maybe that one.
Yeah,
all right. So here's what happened. I worked in this healthcare company that basically employed a lot of salespeople to sell glasses and contact lenses. And I had gone in as a mystery shopper initially, trying to get a sense of how to help their salespeople be more effective and help them hire the right people. And there was initially in our data, there was a really clear effect that the givers were bringing in the least revenue. So the more time and energy you were devoting to helping your colleagues and your clients, the worse you did. And I went to the data and I found the guy with the highest giver score in his whole company based on time and energy dedicated to others and the lowest revenue. And I asked him, how do you explain this? Why do you suck at your job? I didn't ask it that way. But, yeah. You know, what is the cost of generosity? And he said, well, you know, it's simple. I care so deeply about my customers that I would never sell them one of our crappy products. And I was of course, very inspired by that.
Yeah.
But yeah. What was interesting is when you track this guy in the long run, he ends up becoming the most productive salesperson in the history of this company.
Wow. Yeah.
And I love that. It was really interesting to watch him because what most of the salespeople did was they would go up to their customers and they would try to upsell them right away and say, look, I know you're considering this $80 pair of glasses, but you can really get better sight and better longevity of your product if you spend a little bit more. And he made no effort to sell whatsoever. Instead, he would walk up to people and he would just say, yeah, I'm interested in why you're here and tell me a little bit about what you might be using your glasses for. He'd ask a lot of questions, make very, very little attempt to sell them anything. And then they would often develop a ton of trust and come back and say, you know, I'd really love your recommendation on what I should do. And ultimately, he brought in a lot more revenue that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing is, again, like that comes down to people being able to smell, you know, self-interest, sell, you know, that there's some sort of bullshit in the room rather than like that it's an actual genuine concern.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, there are some takers who are really good fakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say. That.
Well,
it's,
and
it's
the
also
examples. Yeah, I mean, the Enron examples are amazing. Yeah. Like, could you tell us a bit about those?
Yeah, so I read this this study by Chatterjee and Hambrick, who got a bunch of Wall Street analysts to rate CEOs on a taker scale. So they asked, you know, after interacting with CEOs, how selfish, narcissistic, egotistical are those people? And then they started looking for clues that would indicate which CEOs were the takers without ever having to meet them or even get them rated. And one was that the taker CEOs actually, in their company's annual reports, they had larger photos of themselves. And they were
awesome.
More likely to be pictured alone.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, shocking, right?
Yeah.
But what I found amazing was you could actually measure the size of the photo. And, you know, the takers were more likely to have a full page devoted to their heads.
This is what I love about people like Adam Grant. I just love that, you know, these are the kinds of things. This is why books like this are so much fun, man.
Yeah. And then also, specifically, Ken Lay's photo. What was Ken Lay's photo like?
Yeah, so in 1997, 4 years before Enron collapsed, if you look at that annual report, there's a full page devoted to Ken Lay's head.
To his head?
And then, you know, 3 pages later, or sorry, 3 years later, there are actually 4 different photos of him in the annual report. Which sends a pretty clear message, right? I'm the most important person in this company. It's all about me.
Yeah, posing on a log, and splitting wood.
Well, Brian, that's your annual report.
That's me, sorry. The Brian Callen Podcast annual
report. Revenue, $0.
$0, but take a look at these thighs. I shaved them.
You know, and that's where we come into diving, right?
Well, no, here is what I was going to ask. Is this a byproduct of a rich society, a society that has a lot to give? Because and you have to be careful about being anecdotal, but my sense is that this sentiment, this philosophy, has permeated a number of companies. I think of Silicon Valley and stuff, and look at IBM. IBM is very environmentally responsible, and there are a lot of examples like Starbucks,
Zappos.
Is this a new thing? And if it is a new thing, a new trend in multinational companies, etc., when did it start happening, and why?
And are we going to see more of it?
Yeah, I don't know that it's new, right? So we started seeing more and more companies pick up these kinds of activities in the 1970s in the U.S. And I think, you know, it was sort of going hand in hand with increasing recognition that the governments can't solve most important problems on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are growing amounts of resources in the private sector that can be dedicated to dealing with really important social issues. And, you know, there starts this conversation about, you know, should a company basically exist only to serve shareholders, or should it also be about a community and a group of stakeholders? And I think, you know, there's obviously increasing public distaste with companies that operate like takers. And I think we are going to see more of it because it's very hard to develop any kind of employee loyalty or customer loyalty if you don't have some kind of ethos about giving back.
Well, mm-hmm. look at Nike and the sweatshop things in the 80s and et cetera, et cetera. People, you know, tuna fish that was caught in these huge nets. And I mean, I do think if you give people a choice, they like to vote with their pocketbook.
You know? Yeah, I think that's true. And there's a ton of research now showing that people will, you know, go out of their way to actually spend more money for socially responsible products. You know, they'll actually invest more in companies they believe are trying to do good. But it's really interesting because if we take this back to the individual level, if you study takers, one of the things you'll find is that they tend to go green to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So like one of the studies I loved on this out of the University of Minnesota took people who had really selfish values and asked them to make a purchase on Amazon where nobody could see them. And they picked the most luxurious products. And then when they had to make that same purchase in public where other people were watching, then they chose the green, environmentally friendly products.
I kill them. Kill them.
No, Brian, convert them.
How do you convert?
That reminded me of that South Park episode where there's the smug alert.
Yeah, exactly.
Smug. How do you change? Can you change takers? How do you do it? I mean, besides with social pressure and you know having cameras on them at all times, is it possible?
I think it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, I think the first question you have to ask is why is this person operating like a taker? Is it because they're a narcissist and they think that if they want to win, somebody else has to lose?
I'd say sometimes that's the case, but other times it might just also be the fact that they think there's only a certain number of pieces to this pie, and I got to get as much as I can.
Well, it's scarcity. Famine scarcity thinking. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, if that's the case, right, you want to try to figure out how you can demonstrate to them that in the long run there's more abundance than there is scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is another kind of taker that's pretty hard to change. That's called the psychopath.
Yeah, well, that tends to be a form of brain damage from
I think if you can understand their motives and kind of what's driving them to believe that they have to get more than they give to get ahead, then sometimes you can break down those beliefs and show them there's another way. But usually my experience and when I track the data, you kind of have to fail pretty big and just realize that you've committed some kind of reputational suicide in order to start rethinking your entire system of values.
We've seen plenty of, I mean, especially now in the age of social media, like there are plenty of people who fail really big, right? There, you know, Anthony Weiner, like all of these people who do things that are, or, you know, Ken Lay, Jeff Skilling. But there's the other thing is that, you know, society doesn't really have a means for redemption. Like there's no scenario in which like Bernie Madoff admits the errors of his ways and suddenly the community welcomes him back in. And
The Americans love a second act and they love redemption.
Yeah.
I mean, I guarantee you Ray Rice in a year after counseling is going to get reinstated in the NFL.
Well, by the same token,
look at Michael Vick. You know?
F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American life.
Well,
but
whatever.
That's just F. Scott
I'm
Fitzgerald.
I'm talking to Adam Grant, who's smarter, who's a better athlete and smarter.
And better writer than that hack Fitzgerald.
I was going to say,
yeah.
Adam, take it away.
Oh, yeah, where do I go with that?
Who knows?
No, there's actually a couple studies on this a few years ago. A colleague, Allison Fregale, found that the higher you are, the harder you fall.
Hmm.
And she had a really interesting explanation for this. So, you know, like a lot of people think we're just jealous of people who are at the top. And when they commit some kind of fraud or they do something wrong, like we really want to see them punished for it. And that is sort of the matcher instinct, right? Like if you have sort of gotten away with something you should have, then you deserve to suffer for your crime.
Hmm.
But she found there's another factor at play here, which is like Tiger Woods is sort of a great example of this. The higher you are, the harder it is to basically make excuses for your mistakes on the basis of lacking competence or knowledge.
Mm.
And so, you know, if somebody is like low on the totem pole and they screw up, you can kind of say, well, maybe they didn't really know.
Mm,
or maybe they weren't capable. But if somebody's achieved extraordinary success and they make a mistake, it's got to be because they had the wrong values and sort of bad intentions. And so we punish them more for that reason, too.
And of course, but that also doesn't recognize the difference in skill domains. Just because Tiger Woods is an expert at golf, that doesn't mean that he's an expert at how to build a marriage. Right?
Yeah, but for me, you know, Adam, for me, when I saw Tiger Woods give that apology, I was like, dude, can you just stop with the speech? Do me a favor. I would have loved to have him say, you know what, guys? I've had to be perfect my entire life. My dad had a golf club in my hand when I was 3, and golf is such a precise game. And guess what? I I just got tired of being perfect and I wanted to do something bad and naughty and I'm sorry. And guess what? I'm a really famous athlete. I'd never had this kind of female attention before. I didn't know how to handle it. And I behaved pretty much outrageously. And I'm going to try to be a better person. It's really hard. I think every guy, at least in America, would go, dude, I get it, man. I understand. You're faced with options that I'm not. And, you know, you went a little crazy. You ate too many cookies or whatever. I really think we'd be more compassionate that way. I don't know.
I think you're right about every guy in America, or at least many of them. I'm wondering about how the other half of the population would react.
I think way more sympathetic than people think. I've had very candid conversations with women about that. About, you know, I think women, in fact, in many ways are even more forgiving if you throw yourself on the mercy of the court. If you say, guess what, I got a problem. You know, I have big appetites.
But the interesting thing is that we've also, like, now we're so aware of what the things you're supposed to say in that situation are that there are so many people who have, like, these very disingenuous confessions.
But you know the difference, don't you, Adam? Don't people have good antenna for when they're being lied to, even if the liar is real slick?
Yeah, I think most of us do. I think it's interesting when you track this, givers actually turn out to be better lie detectors than takers do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody assumes the opposite, right? Like, it's the takers who are skeptical, and so they must be the best judges of character. But the mistake that takers make is they don't trust anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't get to see the full range of human behavior. Right? They always have their guard up. Whereas givers are much more likely to habitually trust, and sometimes they get royally screwed over. Other times they get to see sort of what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. And that gives them more data to kind of learn what differentiates the liars from the truth tellers. And so, you know, ironically, I think it's the people who are sort of the most gullible, right? The givers who are typically the most trusting, who also do the best job when they try to pay attention to it, spotting the liars among us.
Do we see a change in the ratio of givers to takers depending upon the circumstances in a society? For example, when a society is in crisis, do people automatically stop giving?
No, they don't. So one of the best predictors of sort of whether a society develops a lot of givers versus takers is the combination of poverty and extreme weather.
Mm.
So there's a study of values around the world, and where you see the strongest taker values are in places where obviously there aren't a lot of resources, but also it's just insanely hot or cold. And it's hard to maintain self-control. It's hard to feel like there is enough to go around. And so it becomes sort of every person or family for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the data on fluctuations in what's going on in a country, is there a crisis? I think a lot of that is dependent on leadership, right? Is the focus of the crisis, we've all got to protect ourselves? Or is it about we're going to respond to this by figuring out how we can all help each other become better off?
To what extent do you think, if any, obviously, I think the marketplace has done a very good job if left alone. You know, consumers, like you said, will pay a premium if they think the company is being socially responsible, etc. Is there a role for government to play in this at all? I mean, I'm always wary of any central authority, you know.
You should also be wary of the phrase left alone, because that's the point is, I think, and obviously as a business professor, you can speak to this, Adam, but, you know, there's this fantasy that floats around that, like, a truly fair, inclusive, competitive marketplace is one in which the government does nothing. But there's a reason why we have antitrust laws.
Sure.
Like, to some extent, the market there need to be rules on the game.
Yeah, I have a hard time actually developing a clear opinion on this, because I feel like all the data that I've read, and I'm very much a sort of a consumer, not a producer in this area, right? Like, as an organizational psychologist, I know people. And so when I read this stuff, it's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but it seems to me that basically people are able to generate evidence for what they already believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can find a lot of good data that government should back off. You can find a lot of good data that government should get more involved. And I don't know who to believe, because everybody already has an opinion before they've gathered the evidence.
Mm.
Well, but that's also, I mean, that's why we have the scientific method, hopefully, to find tools to be able to sort through that, right?
Ideally. And I think in this domain, we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean...
with Mike Malice, we were going to have him on the podcast, who wrote the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. He's a great guy, really funny guy, but a very cynical outlook on human nature. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, the better angels of our nature and Steven Pinker's work and proving that essentially less people have died violently in since 2000 and the world is becoming a less violent place. And he said, well, that's only because people don't have as many outlets. They can't get away with it. They're being watched more. That's why that is. It's not because people and their nature has somehow become better. Rather cynical, but kind of made sense to me.
Well, of course it makes sense, but I think that's also, this also speaks to what Adam's saying, right? Which is also the point that Jonathan Haidt has made, right? People come to emotional conclusions about things, and then they then gather facts to support what they already feel. Mm. And so, you know, Michael is a cynical guy, and he reaches out, and, you know, he chooses Lord of the Flies as an example of human nature, like hardly a surprise.
And Adam, you would disagree with that. In yes, Lord of the Flies is classic, but ultimately it's the kid with the biggest heart. We've seen data that kids with the biggest hearts in school are the ones that rise to the top socially.
Yeah, and Lord of the Flies is a story, as everything is.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think human nature is always going to be mixed and multifaceted. Mm-hmm. Darwin wrote back in the 1800s, actually, that if you could get a whole tribe of altruists, of people who are willing to sacrifice themselves, that tribe would actually be victorious over other tribes because everyone would focus their energy and talents on making sure that the tribe survived. And, you know, there's a huge debate about this, but there is at least a compelling argument to be made that we are evolved to care about others and that actually natural selection favored some degree of, you know, thoughtful and selective giving. That's not to say we don't also have selfish and aggressive instincts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill Gates probably put it best when he said at Davos a few years ago that there are really two great forces of human nature. There's self-interest and caring for others. And it's not one or the other. It's a hybrid engine of the two that really drives the economy.
Well, there's no question that there's a lot of, I mean, I think if you were going to war, the enemy you wouldn't want to fight is the enemy fighting for something, an ideology. You know, rather than going to war because they hate you, they're going to war because they love what they're trying to protect. If you go into a country and somebody's trying to protect their family, it's going to take you three bullets to bring that guy down, not one. I mean, you know, It feels as though you can talk to a lot of people about, you know, history would bear that out for the most part. The fiercest soldier is that the guy fighting not to take over your land, but the guy protecting his land.
Yeah, I think it would be really useful if people stopped arguing about, you know, what are we? What is human nature? We've got to boil it down to one thing. And instead say, look, we're capable of a whole range of these kinds of behaviors, and let's figure out how we can design a society that brings out the best in people.
Exactly, right? So really embracing the full complexity of what human nature is. I mean, you know.
But when you say design a society that way, that's really ambitious. And you can see why people go, hold on, who's going to design it? What are you talking about?
Well,
let the marketplace decide.
We've been trying to design societies forever, even by, you know, you have to remember that even capitalism is a design, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a response to mercantilism, and Adam Smith came along and said, let's have a different design for our economic system.
Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I had a fascinating conversation last month with Larry Page about this. So he was talking about sort of the role of Google in building a better society. And he said one of the things that he would love to do is create some test worlds where you could experiment with different forms of marketplaces and governance to see, you know, was Churchill really right when he said that democracy is the best form of government? And then he said, well, no, actually, it's the worst form of government except for all others.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't feel like we've experimented with enough ways of organizing people to know if we really have the best model. And you could say the same thing for, you know, do we have the right version of capitalism? I don't know. How many good experiments do we have?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
But also, yeah. I mean, with any model, of course, you know, you really have to make sure that your assumptions are right, right? I mean, 2008, right, the whole housing crisis, that is a perfect demonstration of what happens when your assumptions are wrong. And I think the danger is, you know, always, I mean, we're now in the age of the technocrat, right, where the technocrat believes, you know, in the ability of their models and their mathematics and all of those things. But if the assumptions about human nature that you put into Larry Page's virtual worlds are wrong, well, then you're going to end up validating a system that, in fact, doesn't work in practice.
Exactly. And I think more often than not, these things become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
So the more people think that everybody is a taker, then the more they will create a world where that's exactly the kind of behavior that dominates.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see your work. You know, if you look at Washington, D.C. and the way it works now, it's a battleground for corporations battling not for Main Street, but rather for their bottom line. When in 2010, when you've got, you know, all these challenges facing, you know, the Republic, and it, the biggest fight on the floor in Congress is over swipe fees at ATMs, you know something's going on. You know, I wonder if these corporations that send their lobbyists, and because that's how you have to do business nowadays, to Washington, I wonder if this could permeate sort of some of that thinking. Special interests are kind of killing our republic.
It's not how you have to do business, and this is where government is important, because that's how they're allowed to do business. Like, the rules have not been put in place that prevents them from being able to do that. And again, also, it's not just corporations. Like, special interests come in many forms.
Mm. Yeah, they do. And I think that, unfortunately, you know, if you look at our political system right now, it's very difficult to sort of operate in a way that's not along the lines of this sort of taker ethos, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you see a lot of people drawn to politics because they think it's one of the best ways that they can improve a society. And then they quickly find out you have to spend so much of your time either, you know, basically doing favors for others so they'll do larger ones in return, or, you know, just getting people to give to you without having any intent of reciprocating whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I would actually love to see a redesigned election process whereby all of the people that you have screwed in the past have the ability to take you right out of the system to begin with.
Ooh, that's interesting. How would that work? That's an interesting theory.
I have no idea how to do it in practice.
Leave that to the you know, the technocrats.
But I mean, you know, that's the, I mean, as I seem to recall, I mean, there have been moments in American government where there is, you know, like, for example, right, part of what happened after the Civil War was certain people were allowed to never run again for office, right? And there also, I mean, with impeachment, one of the things that's available is the possibility that you impeach someone and they can never, ever run for elected office again.
Yeah, and I think it's an overly limited group of people who have that say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Are there, and do you find from your research, are there still, you know, I think it was Barb Oakley or someone that we had on the podcast, but are there a lot of people at the top who got there because they are sociopaths? Do you find, because we had Dotliv Schlemmer, what was it?
Detlev Schlechter. Yeah.
Yes, Detlev Schlechter is a social scientist out of Berkeley who was...
No, you're thinking of Dr. Keltner.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Keltner.
But we did also have Detlev as
God,
well.
God, man. All right, Dotliv, anyway.
Dr. Keltner.
Dr. Keltner. I'm so bad with
Docker, names. There you go.
Dr. Keltner.
But he's at UC Berkeley.
Anyway, sorry, Adam. But you know, essentially, he was saying, again, what you're saying, that people in business who are rising to the top are not the sociopaths. They get found out way before they rise to the top. Is that true from your experience?
I think it is oftentimes. It's not always true, right? So you do find a higher proportion of sociopaths in the corner office than you probably do in everyday roles. And I think that there are some people who get there because they're just insanely competent. You know, this actually comes up a lot in the context of Steve Jobs. People are always asking, you know, do you think Steve Jobs was a giver or a taker? And, you know, I think certainly we can make a long list of the taker behaviors in his past. We could also say, you know, yeah, he was really passionate about bringing products out into the world that people really found useful. But I think a lot of people look at that and say, if you just focus in on the large number of taker behaviors, isn't that the path to success? And isn't that easier to do if you're a little bit sociopathic? And I always want to ask, you know, when those conversations come up, how do you know that he succeeded because of those behaviors and not in spite of them?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question, because I was just going to say, when you said that, regardless of whether he's a giver or taker, I love his products.
And he
took into account what I really needed as a consumer, as a human being, what I would pay for, what I would pay a premium for, and something that never broke down and something that just made my life more fun and easy. So
even if he was a taker within the company, he was a giver to the larger world.
Potentially. But, you know, if you look back at his history, you start to wonder, would he have been kicked out of his own company
mm-hmm.
if he had been more of a giver?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, would we have had to wait more than a decade for the triumphant return?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you come up with, what motivates you besides the fact that you like to, I mean, why are you a magician, for God's sake? Why diving? Besides the fact that you're probably flexible and athletic, I hate this guy. I hate him. He probably Adam Grant probably looks great in a Speedo. So, you know,
Brian, let's take a step back there and say, I got into diving largely because it was a nerd sport. I had a coach who said, "Look, you're too short for basketball, too weak for football, too slow for track. So let's try this thing out, and maybe you can get halfway decent out."
I don't know, man. All American is better than halfway decent.
So wait a minute, diving is the chess of athletics.
I never thought about it that way, but I'll say a yes.
That's awesome.
No, on the magic front, I actually got into it. I was a really shy kid, and I had some neighbors that I babysat for who were pretty hyper, and one week they got into magic and I noticed they sat still. I went home and learned some tricks and found that I really enjoyed performing, and it was a good excuse to come out of my shell. And so I ended up bringing some like tricks to school, and people asked me to perform, and one thing led to another, and I became that dork who starts a magic club in college.
Oh, you had a magic club. I would have made fun of you. Let's bully Adam. Let's bully the
totally
smart guy.
I totally deserved it. I'm sorry that you didn't make fun of me for it.
Adam, did you know Dave Kwong?
Yeah, so Dave and I co-founded this magic club.
That's
together.
What I thought. Yeah.
He's done the
That's
podcast,
so funny.
As has David Blaine, who's a good friend of mine. I've known David since he was 17. So I saw David do his first magic tricks, and then watched him just kind of – he really figured out a way to be the grooviest, coolest magician on the planet.
Yeah, I thought magic and cool was an oxymoron.
Not when David Blaine came along.
Yeah.
But the biggest nerd is Chris Angel with those holes in his jeans. I can't be friends with that guy.
But you
Why
are.
Why do you hang out with so many magicians?
No, only David Blaine, not Chris Angel. What was it, though, Adam, that what was the eureka moment for you? Where do you think you – well, first of all, you don't strike me as the kind of guy who would say, I want to be a professor of business. What does business mean to you? Organizational theory and things like that. That's more, you're more into the human behavior that about of business, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's dead on. So I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, and I wanted to figure out what we could do to sort of understand behavior better and try to improve the quality of life. And I decided at some point in college that I wanted to focus on work, because we all spend the majority of our waking hours at work, and most of us don't find our jobs all that motivating or meaningful. So that was sort of the natural connection, is to say, look, if I want to be a psychologist who studies work, most of that, goes on in a business school. And so I am a little bit of fish out of water. I had an introducer a while ago who called me the guy who studied altruism in the Temple of Greed.
Yeah,
I thought that's not quite what I want to be known as, but not. I guess
it does
not
sound
not
like
a
It sounds pretty colorful. The Temple of Greed.
It sounds like an Indiana Jones movie.
I know. Well, tell me who were your heroes? Who were the seminal thinkers in your life? Who were the people that changed your paradigm?
And the books. The books.
And the books. Yeah.
Oh, there were so many. I think book-wise, there were two books that kind of led me to think, I want to go down this road. One was Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, which you guys have probably read.
Yeah.
I had it assigned for a freshman seminar, and then I took another class that assigned it, and I loved it so much that I read it both times.
Wow.
And I had never realized that you could study human behavior in such a systematic way, and from my perspective,
I've not read it, but I'll be.
Oh, you've got to read it. Useful because I was always getting manipulated and taken advantage of. And I read about all these persuasion techniques and realized, I can recognize those and defend myself more effectively.
Mm.
So that was one. The other was Malcolm Gladwell, The Tipping Point. I thought the combination of storytelling and studies was just brilliant and profound. And I was like, wow, I want to try to understand how to do that one day.
Mm.
We have a slightly unusual experience because we have such a range of people from different domains. But I think one of the interesting things is that we're at this moment now where whatever domain you're looking at, whether you're looking at psychology or neuroscience or business, there are these patterns emerging about basically us really recognizing our full human nature. And, then how does that permeate into education? How does that permeate into health? I mean, it seems like we really are at a moment where that's all changing. But at the same time, we haven't crossed that threshold where there's that real interdisciplinary collaboration between people in different fields.
No, we haven't. And I think as a psychologist, it's especially hard because, people hear psychology and they picture, Freud sitting on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you talk about economics and they're like, wow, smart people crunching numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a little bit of an uphill battle to say, like, no, this is a social science that's based on data. And that doesn't mean it can't be fun, but it actually has some rigor behind it.
Well, and if anything, it actually has more rigor behind it. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, part of what we started to realize about the dismal science economics is the degree to which they do really come up with these models that are mathematical and pretty and not necessarily grounded in a whole lot of reality.
You said it, not me.
Well, what are the things that frustrate you the most when you just look at the world? And I mean, you're obviously involved in trying to change a lot of things, but what are the things that really drive you?
There's so many things. I think one of the big items is just how many people make decisions based on intuition, mm-hmm. and there are good data out there. I see this all the time when I work with leaders. I think it's especially common among CEOs. Right, who have been reinforced sort of their whole careers for having so-called good judgment.
Yeah.
And, you know, to say, you know, you're running an organization that's going to influence the lives of thousands and thousands of people, and you're just going to make up the answers to what decisions you should choose, to me, that's borderline insane.
It's so human, though, isn't it? You know, when
but it's modern. I mean, it really does come out of that Enlightenment ideal of the genius, right? The lone individual. Like, we so built this mythology of the magical CEO who has some gift, and then we just all. I mean, you know, Ken Lay bought into that. Jeff Skilling bought into that. You know, Suzanne Cain and her book.
My instincts. You hear things
exactly.
Like my instincts, right?
Susan Cain in the book Quiet, right? The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking talks about how Harvard Business School really reinforces that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Susan's a good friend and one of my all-time favorite writers. I thought Quiet was an absolutely fascinating and life-changing book. And I think it captures, I think, better than any other this tendency we have to sort of favor the people who are able to make these quick, sort of spontaneous decisions based on gut feelings. And yet, if you look at the data, those are the worst decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
So why do we trust them? Why do we listen to them?
Ostensibly, it's because they have developed good pattern recognition, and they can look at something and say, this isn't going to work. This is going to work because all the
yeah,
part.
But in
that,
practice,
that would be the idea.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you're always surprised that CEOs don't actually take into account the data and the empirical measurable evidence, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think part of that is because they just don't know the data are out there sometimes, or they don't know how to gather them. But even when they do, a lot of executives fall victim to this, what you might call the organizational uniqueness bias, which is they think their organization is fundamentally different from all others. And, you know, as somebody who works with a lot of different organizations, I think they're more similar than they are different. And I've rarely gone and found, you know, a result in one organization and discovered the opposite in a different one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you are dealing with some degree of human nature. And I would love to tell, you know, more leaders, look, just because other organizations are different from you in some ways doesn't mean you can't learn from the evidence that they've gathered.
Do you think you could talk to Putin?
Good luck.
I mean, yeah. Jesus.
And like, and also Kim Jong-un. Like, we have a list of world leaders we'd like you to talk to.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, strangely, they're not returning my calls.
That's outrageous.
That's probably because they don't actually, I mean, Kim Jong-un, at least, telephones may not work in North Korea.
Yeah,
so,
that's
you know.
True. Are you calling Vladimir Vlad? Call him Vlad. I you know, it's funny how a guy like that who runs an entire country and has been in power for so long can be so blind to his...
Yeah, but that's why he's so blind. I mean, to go back to the man whose name we butchered repeatedly, Dacher Keltner, right? He studies the psychology of power, and so much of what he's found is that when people have power, it makes them more impulsive for both good and bad, and it also makes them less able to empathize with other people. Like, absolute power really does corrupt absolutely. Like, it does weird things to people's psychology.
Yeah.
Yeah, although there's an interesting twist on that that's come out recently, which is, power corrupts. But what I've come to believe more and more is that it has an even bigger effect in the sense that power reveals.
Mm.
So if we sort of run this through the language of givers and takers, what happens is takers are good fakers as they're sort of moving up the ladder. Right, they might do some of this kissing up and kicking down, but for the most part, they're careful to maintain a good image. And then once they're in power, they're like, all right, I don't need to fake anymore. I'm just going to drop all the pretenses, and you know, now nobody can hurt me or do anything to undermine my success. So now I will basically show you what my true character is.
So, Brian, when you get really famous, we're going to find out who you really are.
When I have an entourage, when I have an entourage, a very colorful entourage, and suddenly I'm speaking this way for no reason at all. The way Madonna all of a sudden starts, her name was Madge, and so apparently all the way from Detroit, now she speaks this way.
Detroit.
Almost like a William F. Buckley, if you remember the way he spoke. Well, if I were to romance your argument, Adam, which I would never do in the real world, I was like, is this guy from, where the fuck is he from?
I have no idea what you said, but it sounded really smart.
Thank you. That's the idea. Yeah. That's exactly the idea.
It's like the great Kissinger has this great line where he said, you know, that he'd reached the stage in his career when people didn't understand what he was saying. They assumed that it was because they were dumb, rather than that he made no sense.
Well, his brother, Kissinger's brother, speaks with basically no accent.
Oh, really?
Yes, and they said, why do you speak with no accent, and why does Henry speak with such an accent? He said, well, because Henry never really listens. He does all the talking.
Oh, wow.
A really, really revealing kind of comment.
Wow.
And on that topic, Adam, are there leaders, and I'm thinking of Bill Gates, who's been so generous and so altruistic and so responsible socially, are there leaders that you are very impressed with in terms of how well, I guess, they give, how much they give versus how much they take?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the hard thing about this is that the takers are always more visible.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the ones like hogging the spotlight and stealing the credit, and the givers are usually like quick to sort of make sure that somebody else is being recognized. But, you know, if I were going to rattle off a list of leaders who have impressed me most sort of on the giving dimension, I would say Jacqueline Novogratz, who runs the Acumen Fund.
Mm.
Sheryl Sandberg, I think, is one of the most thoughtful givers that I know.
Facebook CEO?
COO.
Yep, COO. And I would probably also throw out there an unexpected example, but let's take Stephen King.
Mm. Huh.
Who's been known to do things like go on the Today Show to promote the book of an unknown author because he really believes that great novels ought to get out there.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So here's an interesting question, or maybe it's a really boring, stupid question. But, you know, what I would love as a voter is to, like, have a full psychological breakdown of each of the candidates. Is that, I mean, obviously, if you want to talk about getting, you know, partisan and all that sort of stuff, but presumably there are people like you who are really committed to empiricism who, you know, you do basically like their Carol Dweck mindset score, you do their giver taker score, you do all of these things. And let's like have a full profile on, okay, Mitt Romney is like this, Barack Obama's like this, Hillary Clinton's like this.
I would absolutely love to do this. And as somebody who doesn't believe in political parties,
mm-hmm.
I want to vote for a candidate whose values and leadership skills I respect, regardless of whatever their ideology is. I think this would be right up my alley. I'm working on a project right now to try to figure out, can we identify the language of givers and takers?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you look at like spontaneous comments and debates and press conferences, that might be enough. And it would be fascinating by the time the next election rolls around to roll that out.
You heard it here. You heard it here on this podcast.
But I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think, there's a dream team you could get together. I mean, you know, people like you and people like Carol Dweck and people like Dacher Keltner. Apparently, that's how you say his name. Dacher. Yeah, I got it right this 12th time. But the, you know, if you could start to build all of that stuff out and then you could like present that, you know, you get Nate Silver together to do whatever statistical analysis. But, you know, build that dream team. And yeah, I mean, as a voter, I would love that.
I would too, although there's something that I'd like to see happen first,
mm-hmm.
Which is I just think it's embarrassing that we have never had a woman president in this day and age, and it looks like Hillary is probably going to run on the Democratic side. I think if that's the case, the Republican Party should guarantee that they will only put forward female candidates so that we're assured of having a female president.
Listen, you liberal son of a bitch. I don't know what you think this is. I don't know what kind of podcast
now,
you called
minute,
into.
Are you being a giver or are you being a faker? Like, are you just saying this? Are you, wait a minute, you're married, right?
I am.
Okay, so it's right. Not just like, well, I don't know. I mean, you know.
I think that's an interesting thing to say. That is true. I think the Republicans' liability is that they keep putting people out there that are...
Yeah, but they put Sarah Palin in and then John McCain, who was going to die in office anyway.
Yeah, well, that's
so,
what I mean.
You know, they did run
they
a woman
but
candidate.
But they don't seem to be terribly sensitive as to sort of the popular flow. I mean, you're putting the guy up there
they
who looks
are
like my, he looks like my boss. Or he looks like
but
my dad.
But they are sensitive to the popular flow. I mean, you know, the Republicans are just responding to a different... different popular flow.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're incredible. I mean, like, the Republicans know what they're doing. I mean, John Haidt, right, has said, like, they do a really good job at appealing to all six moral tastes, whereas the liberals don't necessarily appeal to all of those desires.
A little more wishy-washy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, it's very easy to say, like, yes, I am supporting this because it is something that's going to make me look good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would also say, if you look at the evidence, women are better leaders than men.
What?
What?
there was a meta-analysis that came out earlier this year in the Journal of Applied Psychology showing that when you look at self-ratings, men believe that they're more competent than women, but when you look at other ratings, women are actually rated as more competent in leadership roles.
Okay, can we edit this out?
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah. This is when you have a female sound engineer, like, you
she's
know.
Like, yeah, she's throwing her hands up. That's interesting, though.
It's hardly a surprise, though. I think we've all secretly suspected that for a long time.
Well, they say that men tend to forge ahead even when they don't have the answer.
Yeah.
They are more impulsive. They are more, the you know, you were talking about CEOs who tend to make decisions on intuition or on instinct, quote unquote. Women, are women less likely to do that?
On average, yeah. So, like, Susan Cain, I love this comment of hers in Quiet. She said that, that there's zero correlation between who's the best talker and who has the best ideas.
Oh, boy.
it is usually men who focus more attention on being the best talker than actually developing a quality idea.
Yeah.
Well, and specifically, and you talk about this in the book, that's what's called lecking, right?
Oh, yeah, when peacocks do their mating dance.
Yeah.
And strut around to show off how attractive they are.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a prototypically male behavior in the CEO kingdom.
I'm definitely a peacock.
And that's so much of what male speech is about. It's not actually about communicating content. It's about communicating status.
Yeah, it's like, I am a badass.
Yeah.
Well, that's the one thing that, you know, it took me, and I'm still not there, a long time to, I was realizing that when people would speak, and I was doing a podcast or whatever it was, I was waiting from, I wanted to add to it so people could see that I also knew. Well, there was this researcher, and we were all having dinner in Toronto. It was a bunch of smart people, and he was talking, and I had happened to have read some stuff that kind of was similar. You know, I had read something on his field, and I couldn't wait to show the table. And I realized I wasn't really learning anything. I was just trying to add. You know, I was peacocking.
Trying to show off.
I was peacocking.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to check myself. I was like, I don't
Before
like.
Before you wrecked yourself?
This is the guy in a movie I don't like. I want to punch this guy in the face. And I was being that guy. You know, so there. That's my admission.
Brian, you just showed Tiger Woods how he should have done it.
I need to be more like Adam Grant.
No, we would expect no less from the 41-year-old virgin who knocked up Sarah Marshall.
I don't want to talk about that movie. I don't want to talk about that goddamn movie. How dare you bring that movie up? We are talking about changing the world, and you had to bring it down to the level of a goat, sir.
But don't you love that?
God damn it, I'll never live that movie down. I did that as a favor, and it got everywhere. I was like, all right, I'll do it. I made $6 on that movie.
But here's the great thing, Brian. You know, what we're realizing by the end of the interview is how familiar Adam Grant is with your
oeuvre. Love it. Youngest, smartest professor in the world.
He knows Brian Callen's IMDb page.
I can't wait. I can't wait to come to Philly. I promise you I will roll out the red carpet and would love to have you come in. And for those of you who are going to be in Atlanta, and if you are going to be in Atlanta, I'll be at the Atlanta Improv October 16th, 17th, and 18th. Adam Grant, thank you so much, man. You can come back anytime. Anytime.
Well, I will try not to make you regret that.
Yeah, impossible. Are you writing another book as we speak?
Yeah, just starting to write it at this very moment, which is why I might have sounded distracted in the last half hour or so.
Because you were writing while we were talking. Yeah. We inspired your new book.
Yeah, he just did this interview and finished another book.
That's what happens. Yeah. And he's stretching to do some springboard diving during his lunch break.
And again, the book is Give and Take, and it really is an awesome read.
Yeah.
We won't tell Malcolm Gladwell this, but, you know, you certainly matched him and maybe even surpassed
him. Well, Malcolm Gladwell loves you.
Yeah, so there you go.
I mean, it seems, I don't think you can find anybody who doesn't. I don't know, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, they tend to do some
Yeah, but
reading.
What do they know?
What do they know?
What do they know?
Exactly.
More importantly, Brian Callen loves you, and that's the real mark of success.
Damn,
and now
Brian.
We need to question his standards.
Adam Grant, you're a gentleman, a scholar, and a diver. Thank you so much, sir.
Honor to be here. Thanks, Brian and Hunter.
Thank you so much.
See you in Philly, brother. Later. Awesome. It's just, I love this podcast. I get to talk to people like that.
Yeah.
And thank you, Hunter, for once again finding a guest and bringing somebody
can't,
like that into my brain.
Can't take credit for it.
Oh, really?
No, another one I can't take credit for. This was part of David Sloan Wilson's list. Barb Oakley, Adam Grant.
Like, see, it's all... the difference is you listen. I don't listen to anything. You remember names. I'm going to get checked for Lyme disease.
I would, again, like, you can build that narrative where it's Lyme disease's fault, or you could, like, take ownership of that change your behavior and get better.
You're right.
Yeah.
Change my brain, as Barb Oakley told us to do.
That's right. Or just about 90% of people that we've had on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. You
can Carol
change.
Dweck.
The lesson is you can change your brain. You can change the way you think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this podcast is dedicated to that theme and that possibility.
That reality.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Get on message, Brian.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, I hope you've learned everything. We need music. Broken and haunted my heart. Taking the world by storm. They changed everything. Just get Sammy Hagar, that shitty guy, singing. Oh, Brian Callen and a haunted mart to do a lot of thinking. They get really smart people and showcase them. Boy, that's a bad song.
That's a badass song.
Later.
Brian.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.